On this episode of This Week in Space, we talk to Dr. Pascal Lee, planetary scientist and Arctic adventurer, about living on the Moon and Mars. Also, busy times at the Cape, Ingenuity spots bits of its landing tech, and a flyby of a really big asteroid this week. Stay with us.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is This Week in Space, episode number 9, recorded on April 29th, 2022. Living on the Moon and Mars. This episode of This Week in Space is brought to you by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV has everything you need to level up your IT skills while you enjoy the journey. Visit itpro.tv/twit for an additional 30% off all consumer subscriptions for the lifetime of your active subscription when you use code TWIT30 at checkout. And by Blue Land. Sometimes in order to go green, you've got to get blue. Blue Land, that is. Blue Land was founded on the belief that a cleaner planet starts by reducing waste while creating powerful, effective cleaners for your entire home. Get 20% off your first order when you go to blueland.com/space. Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Space. I'm Rod Pyle, and today my co-host Tariq Malik. How are you, Tariq?
Hello. I'm doing well. Thanks. Hi, all.
The two of us will be joined by our special guest, Dr. Pascal Lee. Hello, Pascal.
Hi, Tariq. Hi, Rod. How are you?
Very good. Thanks for coming today. This is going to be exciting. I'm really glad you could make it. But before we go there, it'll come to a shock to many people that I have an effervescent joke, which I tell every week for my esteemed colleague, Tariq, here. So sadly, today is no exception. Hey, Tariq.
Yes, Rod.
What does a Martian say when it needs more Earthlings for lunch?
I don't know, Rod. What does a Martian say?
Bring me some extraterrestrials.
I love it.
Okay.
Every week I love it.
That's good.
So today, we're here to talk about how humans may one day live on Mars and the Moon. And Dr. Lee has spent a lot of time thinking about this and actually participating in exercises to kind of research and build out this future. But before we go there, we have a couple of headlines. And today, all three come from our good friends at space.com. Busy times at the Cape. SpaceX is coming and going, and Boeing is finally making plans to relaunch Starliner. Tariq, what's going on at the Cape?
Well, it's been a really kind of rapid fire week right now. SpaceX started off with the return of their private mission, AX-1. That's four private astronauts who some of them paid $55 million a pop to go to the International Space Station. They were gone for 10 days. They got 2 weeks because of weather delays to come back to Earth. So I don't know if they actually get four extra free days in space, but you know, I think that they were pretty excited to have a longer stay. That mission was kind of the roadblock to yet another mission. SpaceX then turned around in a couple of days and launched four new astronauts for NASA and the European Space Agency, the Crew 4 mission to the station. They made the fastest SpaceX trip to the station ever, about 16 hours, just about under, about 15 and a half, actually. And they're beginning a whole six-month mission. Meanwhile, actually, as we're speaking, SpaceX is counting down to launch a Starlink mission from its other pad in Florida at the Cape Canaveral Space Force Station. So so it's just been a pretty whirlwind trip for them. And there was a photo, too, last week, actually, while this was all going on, of SpaceX launching another Starlink mission while the AX-1 or the Crew 4 rocket was on the pad and the Space Launch System was on the pad. It looks really sci-fi there with all these different rockets standing there. So pretty busy time, to say the least.
So there's probably something to be said in here about SpaceX launching however many times while SLS is rolling back to the barn and Starliner is holding off till May, but I'm not going to go there.
Yeah. I should point out Starliner, that the date that Boeing is now kind of targeting is May 19th. We're getting very, very close to 1 year now since their last attempt to launch this mission, where they actually had to change out a service module for that Starliner because of a stuck valve that they really couldn't figure out. So this is their second test flight for NASA. It's an uncrewed mission of their space taxi, very similar to what SpaceX does with Crew 4 already. They're on their fourth operational flight, fifth flight for NASA with their launch this week. And if this goes well, It's a 5-day trip to the station. SpaceX, NASA and Boeing hope to start flying astronauts maybe by the end of the year, maybe a little later, early next year.
All right. Next up, Ingenuity spots part of Papa during its 26th flight. It's made 27 now. The Ingenuity Mars helicopter took some pictures of the aeroshell and parachutes from the horse it rode in on, otherwise known as the Perseverance rover. And that assignment was part of planning work for the sample return mission being planned by NASA and the European Space Agency for some of the Martian samples being picked up by Perseverance. So besides the fact that this is a killer photograph, what else is unique about this, Tarek?
Well, one of the interesting things that that Ingenuity has done is it's captured some of the hardware that got Perseverance on Mars. So what it saw was the back shell of the rover's landing system, and that's kind of the protective part. The parachutes were attached to that to slow it on the way down. And the hope is that by seeing this stuff and what happened to it after it separated, you know, knowing how it performed after the fact, can help them plan for the next big mission to Mars, this Mars sample return mission, when they're going to have to land not just a little rover and a landing system, but an actual rocket to launch bits into space. And they want to keep that safe on the way back down. I would say that as someone that likes to see interesting things of Mars, seeing actual hardware from the vehicle itself, which you don't see all that often. You know, normally it hits the ground and all you see are photos that it's taken, is really just a special treat. And it's kind of an added thing because this Ingenuity helicopter was only supposed to make a couple flights in a month and be done with it. We're now past a year and it's still turning out new things.
So 27 flights instead of the estimated five. And one of the things that I think was remarkable, I mean, we've seen the detritus of the bits that come off a lander before from orbit, but we've never seen them like this. And one of the things that was really interesting also, I think, for the JPL folks was the parachute's there and it's mostly intact. And one of the things that is really difficult on Mars landings is when they deploy the parachute, it's coming out at supersonic speeds and they just love to tear. And as one engineer put it to me, parachutes in the Martian atmosphere are like wild animals, really. No matter how you model them, no matter how you test them on Earth and try and model them in computers, it's fabric, you know, and it's just impossible. So it's really just something where they kind of, to an extent, they have to cut across their fingers and hope. So they were very gratified to see that this looked to be like it was pretty much one piece.
Yeah, and to your point, Rod, parachute problems are what's kept Europe's Mars rover, ExoMars, on the ground because they want to make sure that it's safe. Now they can have an after image and know exactly, we built this parachute for Perseverance to do this. Here's what it looks like after the fact, and then use that as a baseline for the next big thing.
Until we can put them on Elon's starships and land them in there, I think this is all a very good idea. Our last story is a near miss for Earth. Yesterday, asteroid 2008 AG33, that's a lyrical name, flew past Earth, missed our planet by about 2 million miles, which seems like a lot. It's multiples of the distance between the Earth and the Moon, but it's still just one more wake-up call. This is a very large asteroid, somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,150 to 2,560 feet across. And remember, the Chelyabinsk meteorite, which came in, was 60 feet wide, and that was the size of a small nuclear explosion in terms of energy output. So when you're talking about an asteroid this size, depending on whose estimates you look up, you'd get a crater somewhere between 4 and 10 miles wide, which is at least twice the width of Manhattan. Some estimates go as high as 14 miles. An ignition radius of between 60 and 100 miles. Some moderate environmental effects. This isn't a civilization-ending asteroid, at least as far as we think, but you would have some crop failures and a number of other interferences. And if you're one of the people in that great big multi-mile crater that it lands on, you probably don't care about the long-term effects. You're pretty upset that it came down your head. So it's just a reminder once more, planetary defense funding is critical. And this is something we really need to be talking about. Now we do have the DART mission, which will be arriving at the near-Earth object Didymos in September or October of this year for a deflection test. It's an impactor. But there's a lot more money being asked for by NASA for both orbital and earthbound detection of these things, because spotting them is a big part of the challenge, because they're really dark and they're in the dark. So they're very hard to to spot. Any updates on DART, Tarek?
Well, we know that they're getting ready. In fact, I was thinking about Psyche just recently, because Psyche mission to that asteroid has just passed a bunch of great big tests. But you know, DART is you know, gearing up. It's going to be a really good mission to not just smack an asteroid, but see what happens afterward. You know, we've hit comets before, and so you know, the last we heard, everything's going well. With that flight, we'll just keep tracking it. Now we've got a few other missions too. The European Space Agency has Hera as well. China just announced that they want to do their own planetary defense mission too. And so there is definitely kind of an uptick in that. Meanwhile, we've got hopefully some samples coming back from another asteroid from NASA's OSIRIS-REx mission later this year, later in the next few years, actually. So,
okay, well, we'll be catching up on that in future episodes.
I should point out, though, that this asteroid isn't gone. Yeah. It does have an orbit, the one that just flew by.
A short one, yeah.
Yeah, so it swings by Earth every 7 years or so. So, it, you know, mark your calendars for Memorial Day weekend in 2029, May 25th, it's going to come back.
And hope it doesn't bump into something on the way and change course, because that would be a bad afternoon for somebody.
That's right.
All right. We'll be back in a moment to discuss living on the moon of Mars with Dr. Pascal Lee, who's been very patient. This episode of This Week in Space is brought to you by IT Pro TV. The world of IT is colossal and always changing. So where do you start to get the updated certs and training you need? Whether you're a seasoned IT professional or just getting started, IT Pro TV is the online learning IT education platform you need to advance your skills in IT. IT Pro TV has 7 studios filming Monday through Friday. They also have the most up-to-date content with every vendor and skill you need to advance your IT career. Their courses go from the studio to their course library in 24 hours and are divided into 20 to 30-minute episodes for easy binging. They make sure you're prepared for your exams with their virtual labs and practice tests. The best part about IT Pro TV is that you can learn and get certified on your own schedule, and it's entertaining. April is Linux month at IT Pro TV. Check out the on-demand webinar with Don Pizzette and Daniel Lowry, focused on choosing the right Linux distro in 2022. IT Pro TV has over 138 hours of Linux training available. Here's a couple of courses you may want to check out. Linux Shell Scripting Basics, LPIC2 Linux Engineer, or Linux Command Line, plus so many more. And don't forget about your IT team. Check out an IT Pro TV business plan for your team today. Visit itpro.tv/twit for an additional 30% off all consumer subscriptions for the lifetime of your active subscription when you use code TWIT30. That's itpro.tv/twit. And use code TWIT30 for an additional 30% off the lifetime of your active subscription. IT Pro TV, build or expand your IT career and enjoy the journey. So for the past 2 weeks, Tarek and I have been discussing getting humans to Mars. We've certainly talked a lot on the show about NASA sending astronauts back to the moon to stay. So today we'd like to talk a little bit with Dr. Lee about how we might actually live on these other worlds, such as the moon and Mars, for the long term. Now, first, I've got to give you a little bit of an introduction, Pascal, and I'll try not to gush too much. We've known each other a long time. And actually, I think I first became aware of you in the 80s from the NSS's magazine, if it was Ad Astra at that time or something else. And I thought, wow, this guy looks like he has a really interesting life. I want to be him when I grow up. Sadly, that hasn't happened. But you're a planetary scientist. You're the founder and director of the Mars Institute, which is certainly unique among the type of institutions that it is. You're also the founder of the Houghton Mars Project, which is an outgrowth of the Mars Institute, and we're going to talk about today. You're a painter. You're a book author. And for all I know, you are a great French philosopher and brain surgeon, sort of like the Buckaroo Banzai of our time. How are you?
Good. Good to see both of you.
So you have a fairly extensive and fascinating backstory, which we can't do justice here today, but I would just like to get a few comments from you. How did you first get interested in space in general and Mars in particular? Because you really, your career has been kind of Mars driven.
As a kid, I grew up steeped in science fiction. In fact, I was spending too much time on television watching space shows like Lost in Space, Star Trek, the first season. And so my parents decided to put me in boarding school, and that's when my academic life got straightened up. But that's how I got interested in space, through science fiction, I think. And then I think for a long while I wasn't sure whether I wanted to, you know, just tinker with rockets or become a scientist. And it's after reading Carl Sagan's early book called The Cosmic Connection. This is a book he wrote when he was already famous, but not as famous as when he did Cosmos. It's an earlier book. Cosmic Connection made me decide that I did not, could not be a rocket scientist. I wanted to be a planetary scientist.
Well, you actually ended up working with Sagan, didn't you?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I was born in the most un-Mars-like place on Earth, which is Hong Kong. And then I went to boarding school in France, and that's when I became aware of Carl Sagan. But that was, you know, such a far dream still to one day meet him. But eventually I applied for graduate school in the United States and became a grad student at Cornell. And I ended up, of course, meeting Carl, but also becoming his last TA, which, of course, was a lot of fun.
I was going to ask Pascal. How do you become a planetary scientist, by the way? You know, do you have to pick a favorite planet first, or are there other prerequisites that you were going to set up?
I was interested in all planets and space travel alongside that. I remember reading another book that really made me in some sense, which is a book that was written in French by Albert Ducos. He's sort of the French space guru he was at the time when he was still alive. And it was called In Search for Life on Mars, À la recherche d'une vie sur Mars. And that was such a fascinating book to me because it was a description of the Viking missions and their early results. So I did start with Mars, actually. I was really in love with Mars from the get-go. And then in terms of becoming a planetary scientist, it's just a lot of homework. A lot of homework, but the sense that, you know, with focus, and perseverance, it ends up paying off. I often talk to kids about, you know, how to become a scientist, and it's not supposed to be pleasant along the way. But once you are a scientist, it's a good life. It's a very exciting life.
Not supposed to be pleasant along the way. I think there's a sweatshirt in that, probably. We talked in the past about this also. So for your French national service, instead of doing a round in the military, you went off to the Antarctic for, was it 401 days?
Yeah, 402.
402 days.
Yeah, at the time I was finishing college in Paris, there was still a draft in France. And most of my friends would be drafted and just accept their fate, which was to go to Germany and spend a year running around with a machine gun. I actually was eyeing this particular spot that they had for one scientist, one geologist, in it at the Antarctic French Antarctic station, Dumont-Durville. I was eyeing that one position for a few years, and 3 years ahead of time, to maximize my chances of possibly getting picked for that slot, I turn in my application by saying that, hey, I was 3 years ahead of schedule, but I will be a geologist by then, and I would like to get that job. Geologist and geophysicist is what they were looking for. Anyway, sure enough, I got in. So that completely changed my life because I went to, like you said, I went to spend over a year in Antarctica. I wintered over at the French base. It was a life-changing experience because, of course, I was seeking that experience as an opportunity to live on some other world, essentially. And it definitely delivered in terms of that kind of experience, but it was so enriching scientifically as well, to just to see the earth, nature, you know, the southern lights. You are in a place like Antarctica, you are in blunt contact with nature, and the cosmos, really. I mean, you see the southern sky, the center of the galaxy is dominating the night sky. And of course, the skies are so cold and therefore still and clear that, you know, you're overwhelmed really by the stars at night. It's incredible. There's a whole universe out there that we don't see anymore from our cities.
Oh, absolutely. And even from driving away from our cities these days, it takes an awful long while to be able to see anything. So, I'm going to have to jump forward a decade or two here. You spent time in the Antarctic, and as you mentioned, you know, part of this was this idea of what's it like to live in another world, on another world. And then about the time I think you and I first got acquainted, it was probably a few years before that, you had opened up a base in the Arctic. So tell us how that happened and why.
Yeah, so after Antarctica, I went to grad school. In fact, I applied to one grad school naively. Just as I was sailing down to Antarctica, I posted my application in Singapore to go to Cornell. And sometime in the middle of the winter, I got this notification that I was expected in Ithaca, New York. I had to look up a map to attend grad school when I came back. But while I was in grad school, I was, of course, longing to go back to the polar regions. I thought that there was really something about them to teach us about Mars, and not just the science of Mars, but how to live on Mars and how to be really efficient at exploring an extreme environment like Mars is. And so even while I was in graduate school, I had my eyes towards returning to the polar regions. And then I was looking at this map of impact craters on Earth. There's about 200, at the time there were about 200 known impact craters on our planet. We're still at about that number. It's about 250 now. There was that one crater that was the highest latitude impact crater on Earth on land. It was on this very remote island called Devon Island, which I found out was the largest uninhabited island on Earth. It's about the size of West Virginia, with even fewer people on it than West Virginia. And in fact, there's nobody on Devon Island. I thought, wow, this is a place where you have an environment that climatically is cold and dry, which is rare on Earth, actually. It's not that common. But in other words, you have a real polar desert. Alaska, all of Siberia, that's not polar desert, that's tundra. It's cold but wet. Here you are in the high eastern Arctic of the Earth, eastern North American Arctic of the Earth, and you are in a cold polar desert. And so it had all the basic ingredients of a good Mars analog: impact crater, large piece of real estate that's unoccupied, untouched. Meanwhile, it's sitting under a climate that's cold and dry and has been for most of the life of that crater. I had to go. This was possibly Mars on Earth. And I think it is.
What does it take to get there, Pascal? I mean, so, you know, I'm here in my New Jersey suburb, and and I took a trip to Virginia. I was at 8 hours in a compact car. But it sounds like getting to Devon Island, it's a bit more of a trek than that.
Yeah, what does it take to get there? Practice. it takes perseverance, actually. These days, we have to first fly into Canada. I travel with my dog, who serves as our polar bear guard dog. So I fly from San Jose, California, to Vancouver first, where I then hook up with other colleagues who are joining us, who live in the Washington State area. Then we fly to Ottawa from there. Ottawa, because it's the sole departure point, really, to head up to the eastern high Arctic these days. And so you overnight in Ottawa, and then you fly the next morning to Resolute Bay in the Arctic with one plane change halfway up to the Arctic. in Iqaluit, which used to be known as Frobisher Bay. But once you're in Resolute Bay, you are in the high Arctic. You are on a separate island from Devon Island. It's on the island that's immediately west of Devon Island. It's called Cornwallis Island. And Resolute Bay has a community of 250 Inuit plus people from down south who run some of the logistics up there for the Canadian government. And then you're patient again. You have to overnight in Resolute. And then the next morning, if the weather is okay, you get to Devon Island. You fly onto to Devon Island on a small twin otter plane. It's sort of a Dash 8 cargo version of a Dash 8 on Tundra tires. You fly into a place where you don't know if the weather will allow you to land or not. So it's always a hit and miss. We have a little dirt strip that's about 200 meters long, so there's not a lot of room for error either. But once you're on Devon, you are on another planet, and it's very rewarding. But it is a 3-day trip, wow. So much like going back to the moon or going.
Except
to the moon.
I guess you wouldn't need a polar bear guard dog when you go to the moon or Mars, right?
You don't need a polar bear guard dog. Yeah, I mean. My dog has never ran into a polar bear yet, but he is sniffing around quite a bit, and we've seen him being alerted to some smells before. So I'm pretty sure that he is smelling intruders. And the polar bear is at the top of the food chain in the Arctic, make no mistake. So even though we have shotguns with us just in case we have an encounter, you know, I'm much happier with my dog as a warning system. And the dog, of course, is not expected to attack the polar bear. It's expected to distract it. And a dog can run faster than a polar bear, but a polar bear is very fast as well. So it's the idea is it's a deterrent. It's a decoy, if you will. It's like those things that you shoot out of Air Force One or Marine One. It's to intercept the polar bear so that it doesn't hit you immediately. We have lots of polar bear jokes in the Arctic. You know, like you don't have to really outrun the polar bear. You just have to outrun somebody else. That kind of stuff.
Oh, you got a rim shot. So you've spent this year will be your 22nd season up there. Is that right?
Well, we had this coming year will be our 25th field season, actually. And we've been trying to hit that mark for quite a while, but in 2019, we had our 24th field season, and after that, we had COVID. And so for the past two summers, we haven't been able to go back to Devon Island, which has been very frustrating. We had otherwise an uninterrupted streak of my spending every summer of my life on Devon Island. I moved to California 25 years ago. Until COVID, I had yet to spend a summer in California. I had no idea what surfing was or... I was on another shore, not for the Pacific.
For all the time you spent up there, I mean, I know you're very busy, but you also you do a lot of research work up there in coordination with NASA and others. So let's talk a little bit about your specialty as Mars, but also living on the moon, because the conditions are not as different as a lot of people might think. I mean, they're both the moon and Mars are radiation saturated. The moon exists in a vacuum. Mars has an atmosphere, but it's not very noteworthy, except for the fact that you can, you know, draw oxygen from it and so forth. But in terms of atmospheric protection, it doesn't offer much. So given that these environments are harsh and really wild temperature extremes and so forth, what sort of conclusions have you come to in terms of the best way to build longer term habitats in these places?
Yeah, you make a good point. I think it's worth emphasizing how sometimes there's a perception that, okay, the moon is pretty hostile, but Mars somehow would be a lot more pleasant. And the truth is Mars is as lethal as the moon is, if not more. And at the same time, farther away. So it's a really big challenge. I often describe the five things that will kill you on Mars in chronological order of cause of death. The first one, of course, if you are unprotected, is the low atmospheric pressure. And although you just mentioned there is an atmosphere there, indeed, it's very thin. And so within seconds, you are dead if you have a depressurization incident on Mars. If that doesn't kill you, the carbon dioxide that the atmosphere is made of is a toxic gas. And so you would die of hypoxia within a minute or two if you did not have oxygen fed to you. If that didn't kill you, then you are dying of the cold. The temperature on Mars is on average minus 80 degrees Fahrenheit. That's minus 63 Celsius. By the time the sun is down, you are frozen to the bones if you are not protected by a suit. And then if that doesn't kill you, the dust on Mars is lethal. And again, there's no exaggeration there. It is replete with perchlorates and peroxides. They're both very nasty for you to ingest. The dust is very fine grained. So the three aspects of the dust that will kill you is the fact that it's chemically toxic, very fine grained, and so will clog the pores of your lungs. That's silicosis. That's what is often known as miner's disease. And the dust is very abrasive. Even though there's a bit of rolling around of the dust grains in the Martian atmosphere, it's still going to be very much like the lunar regolith. It's very shard-like. This notion, for example, of growing potatoes by scooping in tons of Martian dirt into your habitat is completely wrong, because first of all, you would be breathing in all this dirt and you would be dead from the peroxides and the perchlorates within 2 weeks. It's going to attack your thyroid. But second, the potatoes will be poisoned with the perchlorates. And so you're going to die of food poisoning, essentially. So that doesn't work.
You mean Mark Watney from The Martian lied to us? Is that what you're saying, Pascal?
Mark Watney would not have made it the way he did. Yes, that's very clear. And the other thing, of course, is that had he been a really good botanist, he should have known that you don't need dirt to grow food. You can just do hydroponics. So with just a poop and water, he should have been able to grow food if he had a very large supply of poop, which he did apparently. So he did not need to bring in the Martian dirt. That should have been left outside the habitat.
Well, and this doesn't even begin to touch on the fact that he had a massive hole in the side of the cargo carrier that he uses habitat, which he taped a sheet of plastic over in a near vacuum environment. I didn't understand that. Did you?
Well,
can you breathe in a 1/2 PSI environment?
No, you cannot breathe in a 1/2 PSI environment. But I should say that, you know, Andy, I know Andy Ware pretty well. We are neighbors in the Bay Area, and I often tease him about, you know, this or that that doesn't quite work. But he's a really smart guy, and I don't want to take anything away from how exciting his novel is.
No, he did research the hell out of it. But you got to write a story, right?
Yeah. 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 So anyway, the dirt is not benign. The dirt is really nasty, and you want to really be isolated from. In fact, the art of surviving on Mars would be the art of managing the dust, assuming the rest of the life support system stuff is sort of covered. You really have to manage the dust and not come in contact with it as much as possible. And then finally,
true on the moon as well, correct?
Which is true on the moon as well. But the moon's dust, at least, is not toxic, chemically toxic, as far as we know. It's just abrasive and very fine grain. So there, it's a mechanical problem, strictly. Mm-hmm. Where it's a physical problem strictly, whereas on Mars, it's a physical chemical problem. Now, the good news about the peroxides, for example, is that they can be washed out of the regolith relatively easily. So if you run water through your Martian soil, you can wash out the peroxides and the perchlorates relatively easily. And then you have a substrate that is more benign for plant growth and things like that. But then you might wash away some of the nutrients. So we'll have to look into that. Finally, the radiation hazard will kill you on Mars, now on timescales of months to years. And there's a fixation about radiation when it comes to going to Mars, when in fact it's the thing that will kill you the slowest and if at all. So I think it's mainly because there's very little you can do that against radiation that makes it so prominent in our worries about going to Mars. But, you know, if you're worried about dying on a trip to Mars, you shouldn't even be on a rocket. You're putting your life at risk. I think rockets, generally speaking, are less reliable than we think they are. Launches in general, I think. But anyway, you are at risk, a huge risk of death. And it just starts from that point on, you are facing death every day as an astronaut in deep space. And so this business of worrying about radiation, because it's going to increase in a bad year, it's going to increase your chances of having a fatal cancer by about 5 to 10%, you know, for the rest of your life, is in my view sort of a something that we need to relativize compared to all the other dangers we face in a trip to Mars.
Well, one more argument for sending old guys like us out there, because we have that many fewer years to get cancer and die, right? And yeah, if a rocket people, does splat into Mars, it's less of a loss.
Older people have care less about their gonadic information. But the other thing, too, is that when you're older, your cells divide more slowly. This is why cancers are so aggressive in young people. Once you hit your mid-50s, your mid-60s, you are much less prone to cancer. I mean, cancer in very old people is almost indistinguishable from just, you know, normal slipping away, because the cancers are so sluggish, right, generally speaking. So yeah, in fact, this is another misconception in most science fiction movies. In fact, if not all of them, is you always have this very dashing young crew going to Mars, when in fact, because it's going to be a small crew, you have to have a lot of expertise built into that crew. And to build an expertise and experience, you just need time to build that. Therefore, crew members are likely to be, for the youngest, probably in their mid to late 40s, if you're doing it right. And you want a crew that's super experienced in a lot of things, and have people who are seasoned astronauts going to Mars, you know, people who are in their, and I don't mean necessarily professional astronauts, I just mean people who are very seasoned in their experience that's going to be needed for a mission to Mars, like geology or biology or medicine. You want seasoned people going, being part of your crew. And so I wouldn't be surprised if the average age of a good crew for Mars were in the mid 60s.
Well, it's good to finally be to have arrived at the right age for something besides Social Security. So I appreciate that. We're gonna be back in a minute to continue our off-world adventure after this message from the good folks at Blue Land. This episode of This Week in Space is brought to you by Blue Land. Did you know that an estimated 5 billion with a B plastic hand soap and cleaning bottles are thrown away every year? And as if that's not bad enough, each of these bottles can contain more than 90% water. So you're just shipping around heavy water. That's a lose-lose situation for our planet. You know, plastic has been found in 100% of marine turtles, almost 60% of whales, 36% of seals, and 40% of seabird species examined. By 2050, get this, scientists predict that the ocean will contain more plastic by weight than fish. That's serious business. We need to start creating a cleaner planet from home. Blue Land's idea is simple, and it's beautiful. You buy the bottle once, you refill it forever. No more plastic waste. The only thing you need to discard is your outdated idea that eco-friendly products are more expensive or less effective. You just fill Blue Land's beautiful Instagrammable bottles with warm water, pop in one of the hand soap or spray cleaner tablets, and within minutes, you have powerful cleaning products in incredible scents like iris agave, perine lemon, and lavender eucalyptus. From their best-selling clean essentials kit to their hand soap duo and plastic-free laundry and dishwasher tablets, Blue Land has something for every inch of your home. And backed by popular demand is Blue Land's toilet tablet cleaner. Get it before it sells out again. Blue Land's stunning high-quality forever bottles start at just $10 when you buy a kit and are meant to be reused forever, with money-saving refill tablets that start at just $2. Try Blue Land today. You'll love it, and your planet will thank you. Right now, you can get 20% off your first order when you go to blueland.com/space. That's 20% off your first order of any Blue Land products at blueland.com/space. blueland.com/space. So let's talk a little bit about these habitats, because if you're part of the space enthusiast group, which Tarek and I certainly are, because we're journalists, you hear a lot about, oh, we're going to build these things in caves, because that puts lots of rock and regolith over our heads, and that'll protect our habitats from radiation. And you've done some work on this, and there's the situation on Mars but that doesn't quite match up with the situation on the moon. And the current conversation, of course, because we're headed back to the moon, we hope in a few years, with astronauts, seems to revolve a lot around lunar habitats. So what's the story with lunar lava tubes, and why might they or might not they be a good idea?
Yeah, okay, so now we're shifting gears, I guess, away from Devon. I'm interested in caves on the moon and Mars, mainly because, in my view, the caves on Mars are the holy grail for the search for life on Mars. And let me just summarize this quickly. Even today, if Perseverance or Curiosity drove by a rocky outcrop and there were the fossil bones of a giant beast sticking out of the road cut, you wouldn't be able to tell whether it's alien life or not. Okay, I mean, it could look weird. You would write a good paper in Nature, and if Nature doesn't want it, science will pick it up. But the point is, you're not sure you've discovered alien life because you don't have the means to really identify, with certainty that you're dealing with an alien form of life. And this is because Earth and Mars are not isolated systems. We have meteorites that have come naturally from Mars because asteroids or comets, large ones, have hit Mars and kicked off Martian rocks, transferred them to the Earth. The reverse has certainly happened as well. Large impacts on Earth must have lobbed Earth rocks into space, onto the moon, we know already that, but also very probably onto Mars as well. And so microbial life from Earth could have seeded Mars very early in Mars's history. Life could have evolved on Mars, along its own path. And if the fact that we would run into some fossil of a life form on Mars would be exciting, but it could just be descendants of our ancient ancestral microbial cousins. It wouldn't tell you that you found an alien form of life on Mars per se, which is really the reason why we're so fixated on the search for life. We want to know if we're alone. We want to know if life started on its own on another planet. We have to not just find life on another world, but ascertain that it is alien. To do that, you have to do genetics. All life on Earth, all life of the Earth, past and present, shares genetic material in common. We're all part of the same genetic tree of life. And what we're looking for really is something that would be genetically alien to that tree. Precisely another tree of life, something that sprung out on its own, independent of the Earth's tree of life. To do that, you have to find it alive. You cannot do genetics on something that's dead, or at least not dead for a very long time. To find it alive, you have to go underground today on Mars. I think we've now established that the surface of Mars is not optimal for life, as we know it at least, but that needs to metabolize the way normal life does here on Earth. We need to go underground. Underground, the environment is entirely different. And on Earth, caves are in the category of cool things to behold. But on Mars and the moon, caves are incredible opportunities because they now offer something that is radically different from what's happening at the surface. I mean, on the Earth, caves are very different from what's happening at the surface as well. But, life is not at the edge there on Earth to need caves to persist. On the moon or Mars, all of a sudden in caves, you have conditions that are within the realm of what life on Earth could enjoy. And this is why I think exploring caves on Mars, other than deep drilling on Mars, which is, of course, the other way of getting into the ground, but that's very hard. Caves on Mars, which we know exist by the thousands, are, in my view, the number one target we should focus on from here on, both robotic missions and then eventually humans. Search for life on Mars is our big focus. Yeah, so that brings us back to – yeah, sorry. Sorry, go ahead, Terry.
Oh, I'm so excited to talk to you about it. But I was going to ask, so with when you're talking about Mars caves, are you talking about, okay, we're going to send the astronauts to the cave to go in there and look around? Or is that a place to set up shop, like a home, and then to look deeper inside the cave for the life evidence and whatnot?
Yeah, I think there's still too much unknowns about caves, both on the moon and Mars, to really seriously plan around occupying them and settling them. I mean, it's a nice notion that is transposed from the earth that, you know, in a resource-poor environment, that's what caveman and cavewomen did in the early history of the earth. But cavemen and cavewomen occupied caves in limestone mostly, not lava tubes. Very, very rare are the there's no example of a long-term permanent occupation of a lava tube on Earth by humans, by early humans. And there's only evidence for transient occupation of lava tubes. And that's because lava tubes tend to be in volcanic regions that are very harsh to live in to begin with, whereas caves in limestone are by definition carved out by water flowing. And so you're near a river, you're near water. So we, of course, have used caves as natural shelters against the elements, but we've done so in very specific types of caves, which are mostly limestone caves or karst caves, not lava tubes, which have been only, again, rarely occupied. On the Moon and Mars, all we are dealing with, as far as we know, is lava tubes and those kinds of volcanic caves where, you know, unless the volcano is active and venting water, there's no other source of water to behold. So I understand this notion that you want to be sheltered from radiation, of course, micrometeoritic bombardment, stark day-night temperature changes, but you're better off doing that on Mars and on the Moon by sandbagging your habitats. You lay down habitats that are very well built, constrained with, you know where you're going to set them up. You understand that environment very well. It's a controlled setting in that sense. And then sandbagging machines, they already exist. Robotic sandbagging machines, every time there's a flood somewhere, there's something that's scooping up sand in the front and pooping out a sandbag at the back. And it would take relatively little engineering, relatively, to create a robotic sandbagger on Mars or the Moon. And now you just pile on your sandbags to shelter your habitats. That's a lot more controlled. So if you need to grow your base, you move the sandbags around. You know, presumably you have some forklift that will help you do that, or some robotic crane. But it's a lot more manageable than counting on, you know, integrating your habitat into a natural tunnel. Meanwhile, you want to explore those tunnels, those caves, but for their science and also for their resource potentially. The caves that I'm particularly interested in on Mars and on the Moon are the ones that might have ice in them. And, you know, the caves that we think might be present in the polar regions of the Moon, for one thing, could be cold enough to have ice in them. And that, to me, is super exciting, because now the ice might even be more readily accessible than in the polar regions themselves.
I want to talk more about that, but just a quick comment here. You've been a bit of a contrarian in a couple of conversations we've had about lunar lava tubes in particular. I think the widely held perception a few years ago, in fact, there was the confirmation of a very large open area inside a lava tube on the Moon from a Japanese orbiter, large enough to hold a small city. And the space settlement community got very excited about this idea of this enormous cavern down there, which may end up being a good place. But as you pointed out in conversations in the past, this requires some investigation, because we can see from looking at places like Hadley Rill that these may not be ideal, correct?
That's exactly it. I mean, I'm definitely not ruling out us one day using caves and settling them. All I'm saying here is that it's very hard to make plans ahead of time like this, given our limited knowledge of what they are like underground, really, how stable the walls are, how, you know, they're prone to collapse. Until we really know a lot more about these caves, you know, they are just going to remain scientific curiosities and potentially resource opportunities before they're really settlement, targets.
But given the difference of the type of caves you see on the Moon and Mars, if I remember correctly, the ones on Mars, at least that you can spot from orbit, tend to look more like lava pits, and the ones on the moon tend to look more like lava tubes. Is that correct?
You actually see a wide range of types of cave entrances on the Moon. You've got the lava tubes, but also things that are possibly better described as crater pits or pit craters. Mm. We have these two types of cavities in Hawaii, for example, quite widely represented. Mars has those, both types as well, it seems, but also additional ones that are tectonic in origin, so associated with faulting as well. So there's really no single type of cave here on either of these worlds, but indeed on the moon, lava tubes are probably the most common, and the same thing is true on Mars.
Can I ask, Pascal, is there, knowing what you've seen of both like the conditions at Devon Island and then these caves that you're looking at on the moon and Mars, is there one spot on the moon that right now you think is like, or in Mars, so one for each, that you would want to set up shop if you could build a base there right now, to, you know, that's within reach of those caves to go explore, but also has the stuff that you would want to build those sandbags, to build that safe habitat for your crew?
Yeah. Wow. I love this question. First of all, where do you build a base? Okay. And there's a lot of attraction and focus right now on being in the polar regions of the moon, especially the South Pole. But meanwhile, the South Pole is very, very difficult terrain compared to all these Apollo landings, which were done either in the lunar mare, which are relatively flat, or in the lunar, at the boundary between the mare and the lunar highlands, or in the case of Apollo 16, a very exceptionally flat lunar highland location. The lunar South Pole is very rugged, has lots of steep slopes, not to mention a very tricky illumination situation that varies with time. And so if you go on a traverse somewhere, it's not just whether the terrain will allow you to get there, but will it remain lit for you to drive back? And if it doesn't, you know, do you have the autonomy to go through those dark, shadowed areas? And is it going to be safe enough for you to make your way? Anyway, it's a very challenging terrain. And, you know, if you look at how we normally do exploration, you set up your base usually in a place that is much safer and reliable to access at all times of the day, all times of the year. And then you equip yourself with a mobility system that allows you to access all these other places that you're excited to explore. So McMurdo, for example, in Antarctica, of course, was set up in a nice, you know, interesting place, but it's not the center of where the research in Antarctica is done. From McMurdo, you fan out with your mobility system, C-130s for long range, Twin Otters for shorter range, helicopters for even shorter range, and then sometimes you go with ground vehicles to these different locations. So you have your logistical hub in a relatively benign place, but then you have the mobility system that allows you to conquer, so to speak, the rest of that continent. And that is actually the strength of the United States program in Antarctica. It's so much so that this whole strategy has is strategically protected in Antarctica. The United States, for example, sells C-130s to different countries, but doesn't let them equip their C-130s with skis to access Antarctica. And so Chile and Argentina, all these countries who want to go to Antarctica with their American C-130s, cannot put skis on them because it's part of the deal. You don't put skis on these things. And so my point about this is that the mobility system is really what is giving you your strategic edge to occupy, study, conquer this place, conquer in a sort of a to master it, if you will, and. I think we should think of the moon in those terms. You know, we don't know really to what extent the South Polar regions are going to yield resources that are exploitable. We should, of course, explore them. We should send robotic missions and humans, but in forays to sites that are particularly interesting. But as far as setting up our base, I think we should be off the poles and in a place that's a lot more benign somewhere on the moon. I don't know, Clavius, you know, just to follow science fiction. The point is that it could be good almost anywhere else, but in the lunar polar highlands, north or south. Okay. Now, that's, having said that, I would really push for the exploration of these candidate caves that we think we found. They're very difficult to ascertain from orbit in the polar regions, because now you're talking about caves that would be so cold that they could have ice in them. Ice accumulated over eons, just like an impact crater that's permanently shadowed at the poles might have ice in it. Now you could have caves with ice in it. Now, if you have a sheltered environment with ice in it, now you're talking about a serious, you know, wine cellar at the very least. But a joke aside, you now have an environment that's really exciting to explore and that will prepare you for Mars. which is really where we want to go. And of course, on Mars, you were bringing up, you know, would you go in there with humans? Of course, you would send in robots first and then humans eventually if the cave is interesting. My favorite spot on Mars for a base, we proposed it as part of NASA's call for ideas and suggested landing sites. We proposed it in 2015. It's a place called Noctis Landing. It's site number 50 of the 50 or so sites that were proposed to NASA that year. That's, I guess, just an arbitrary number. But that location, I find, is very strategic scientifically and responsive to our needs as a base, because it's at the western end of Valles Marineris on Mars, this giant canyon system. Okay, now, if you head towards the east, in other words, into the canyon, now you have access to this incredible record of rock layers that might allow you to search for fossil life and past examples of life. But most importantly, the site is still at low enough of an altitude that you can, from there, drive up to the volcanoes and access all these caves and lava tubes. So you're between both worlds. You can do extant life search towards the west, past life search towards the east, and you're near the equator, which, of course, is more advantageous thermally. You're in a canyon, pressure-wise, and you are you are in good comms for talking back to the Earth. And we now know that there's plenty of ice there in the ground. So,
well, you know, all of that, it, then taking in mind, because I think when people think about building a base or a place to live on Mars, they're thinking of Elon Musk's vision of a city on Mars with the domes and all of that. How far are we from something like that now? I mean, it, clearly you have to homestead before you can, I guess, metropolize, if that's a word or not.
Yeah.
But how far away then do you think we are? Are we closer than ever before? Is it still, you know, on the fringes of science fiction?
I admire what Elon does, and I support his enabling us to access space more cheaply. But I'm not on board at all with this vision of a huge chunk of human civilization somehow branching off onto Mars. I think that's a real pipe dream. What you have to realize, of course, is that Mars is fundamentally a lethal place. It's as lethal as the moon is, except that it's even farther from the Earth. And with the toxicity of the regolith, it's even more lethal than the moon. At the same time, you know, I don't see the point in having a large piece of humanity who, with technology, would create some sort of an ICU unit, because that's what a life support system is. It's an intensive care unit to put a bunch of people in an intensive care unit on Mars. On the other hand, I do see a future on Mars that would involve research stations, one big base or maybe several others. It's the Antarctic model, which has, by the way, lasted for a long time and continues, and a healthy dose of tourism. So I do see on Mars the opportunity one day, you know, maybe some distance, short distance away from a base, sharing the same airport, so to speak, a bit of a Dallas-Fort Worth situation, where you have a base in the middle, and then, you know, Dallas would be your research base, but then Fort Worth, of course, not at all at those scales of cities. That's my whole point. It's a small research base, but on the other side of the airport, a resort, some sort of an Epcot, where people who travel from the Earth, maybe by the tens at a time, or, you know, the way Elon sees it, once they get there, they will live in a domed environment for a few weeks, you know, have fun with the Martian gravity, swim in that, go out for some token EVAs, take a train ride to the edge of the canyon, but then you're done. There's no point in raising children on Mars so people who would live on Mars for the long term might be your park ranger type person, you know, with his or her family. And then, of course, there would be a rotation of these anyway. And then Same with the scientific crew that occupies the station. But this is very much the model of Antarctica, and it has worked well for an environment that fundamentally is hostile and not really conducive to human occupation. In the 60s, the Chilean and the Argentinians in Antarctica had tried to settle families there. They had built apartment complexes, moved families with some, you know, financial incentives. It completely failed. They eventually repatriated everybody back, and these buildings are now sitting and sort of in a decrepit state in Antarctica and unoccupied, because it's just not a tenable thing, for financially or even in any possible way. It's not tenable to have this large chunk of population living in a place that's so expensive and dicey to live in. Now, this notion that technology can conquer everything, I think that it can be applied much more productively to improving places on Earth where we can live and sustain more people. You know, bear in mind, the other thing is that there's no running water on Mars, okay? So, you know, just sewage and all these things that we flush around all day long would have to be somehow processed. I mean, if we're very long ways away, and again, I think the case of it being desirable has yet to be made. Now, cities in space, giant O'Neillian wheels, I'm on board. That's actually Jeff Bezos's vision. Yeah. I'm on board because now you're talking about a station that can be much closer to the Earth. It's a completely controlled environment. You don't have the vagaries of the Martian surface, and you don't have the environmental impact either of the Martian surface. You can do things in a lot more control way in a station. And I do see a multiplication of big stations for humans to go visit in the future. And as far as the moon is concerned, it's the same thing. Research bases, maybe at some point a tourism-focused facility, a bit like in Andy Weir's book, Artemis,
yeah.
You know, where you can take a train ride to the Apollo 11 site and a few things like this. My hope is that by the time we would really be in a position to somehow send, you know, hundreds or thousands of people to Mars, we will by then have found exoplanets that are nearby with you know, existing habitable atmospheres, an oxygen-rich atmosphere. That's Proxima Centauri Bravo, which is in the habitable zone and is about 1.17 Earth masses. Is that thing habitable? Does it have oxygen in its atmosphere? So James Webb Telescope will tell us. But until we, I think that it's more credible actually for us to envision sending an arc of people, maybe a generational ship to one of these planets and then occupy them than terraforming Mars or living on Mars as it is.
Well,
anyway,
I've
said my part.
Mars ain't the kind of place to raise your kids. Somebody had to say it, but there's a further interesting conversation to be had about why or why not to settle, or to use outdated terminology, colonize these places. And Pascal, you and I have talked about this a lot, about the sort of idea of sorties or expeditionary kind of movements. And I do want to have you back to discuss this more, including what this might cost in a world with or without Starship. But before we run out of time, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about your artwork. There is one more point. It occurred to me this morning, I was out taking my morning walk and I was listening to The Economist radio about Musk and Twitter, which of course has been talked about on the Twit Network quite a bit. You know, we could probably be building condos on Europa for $44 billion. So I know it isn't an all-cash transaction, but for the amount of money that went into this compared to what he spent on Starship, which is still significant and a tremendous achievement, Musk could have had not just his own partial program, but he basically could have just bought NASA and taken the whole thing over. But I digress. Pascal, you're an accomplished painter. I love your work. One of these days I'm going to buy some of it. And I just want you to talk a little bit about your inspiration. You know, did that date in some way back to Chesley Bonestell, who's a brilliant space artist from the early to mid-20th century? And what drives you? Because your work is really quite wonderful and significant.
You know, I've been drawing since I was a kid. My father was an architect and really good at sketching, so I watched him a lot. There was a phase in my life when I was in my, from 0 to 20, where I painted and drew quite a bit. And then once I hit 20, I was so focused on becoming a scientist and wanting to, you know, trying to be good at it, that from roughly 20 to 40, I didn't paint. I didn't do any much artwork. But then by the time I hit 40, I started becoming frustrated. Things in space weren't quite moving at the pace that I wanted. So I started to depict what I thought the future should look like or will look like. And so you will find that in my paintings, I'm sort of trying to really draw what I think our future in space might be like. So I don't know if you can see there, but right here on the left, I have a rocket ship that's powered by nuclear thermal propulsion that's in orbit around Mars and off of Phobos with, you can't see that, but the three little guys that are on EVA. Maybe I can bring that up close.
So this is the mission that should have happened.
Well, this is, I think, what we should really be focusing on. And if NASA has room for the next step, we should really be pushing nuclear thermal propulsion. There was an existing program, as you probably know, the NERVA program, which was canceled by the Nixon administration. But they were almost ready for flight. They had made lots of successful tests in the deserts of Nevada. And I think that program is either already being revived or revisited, but should be aggressively pursued. Because that's right. I don't know to what extent it's known, but it should be aggressively pursued for civilian space travel, and it will open the gates to Mars. And Titan, incidentally, is another place. So I really hope nobody gets this wrong. I'm totally in favor of humans going into space. I just don't see big cities on Mars or the moon as being a good idea. On the other hand, we could go to Titan if we had nuclear propulsion. A journey to Titan with a nuclear thermal rocket could happen in a couple years. In other words, about 2 years to get there. And now Titan is an entirely different world. Titan is actually more friendly than Mars or the moon. The gravity on Titan is even less than on the moon. It's 14% of Earth's gravity instead of 17%, which is what the moon is. But Titan has an atmosphere with a surface pressure of about 1.4 bars. So it has a thicker atmosphere than even the Earth. It's easier to fly on Titan, both because gravity is lower and the atmosphere is denser. That's why Dragonfly actually, of course, is happening. It's an incredible mission that I'm 100% behind. I have just as a supporter, I have nothing to do with it. Titan is a place that you could explore without a pressurized spacesuit. All you would need is, in fact, we're working on a paper that describes this a little bit. All you would need essentially is a well-insulated level A chemical suit. Level A chemical suits, which are made by DuPont and a few other companies, are suits that completely seal you chemically from the environment around you, but are not pressurized per se. So you are donning, first of all, a full face oxygen mask with a couple of oxygen tanks in your back, and then you don this suit that you zip up and Velcro and seal to keep all the gases out of contact with your body and your lungs. But that's good enough. And of course, on Titan, you want to protect yourself from the cold. Temperatures are of order minus 300 Fahrenheit, so minus 200 Celsius. But protecting yourself from the cold, we can do that. We can do. Well, I've experienced minus 200 C with wind chill in Antarctica.
If I remember correctly, if I'm swimming on Titan, for those of us who are a little above our ideal body weight, I'll be a little more buoyant in the ethane oceans there, right? Floating in hydrocarbon seas.
You could be more buoyant, yeah. Now, you know, we still have to answer why would humans want to be on Titan? Well, you know, that's going to depend on in part on what Dragonfly discovers. But it's a very exciting world that has indeed water. I mean, not water, but fluids to contend with and possibly lots of interesting prebiotic chemistry going on. My point is that it would be an incredible frontier to explore that we could. And the radiation environment around Saturn is a lot more benign than around Jupiter. So the surface of Titan, plus it has this thick atmosphere, so you're probably well protected from radiation. You're going to be okay. The surface of Titan, aside from the fact that you are really far from the Earth, is safer than the surface of the Moon or Mars for humans. You spring a leak in your spacesuit, you're not automatically dead.
Well, I just want to point out my ideal candidacy for being the first astronaut to go to Titan, because I grew up in Los Angeles in the 60s and 70s, where the air was very similar to what Titan looks like all the time.
The organic haze?
Yeah. So, you know, living 2 miles from the mountains that I couldn't see, and I'm not exaggerating, was extraordinary. Where can we go to find more about not just your work with the Houghton Mars program, but also with but also your paintings? So give us a couple of websites.
Houghton Mars Project, the best source is probably the Mars Institute's website, and we have a Houghton Mars Project series of pages there. So that's marsinstitute.no or just marsonearth.org. That will get you there to marsonearth.org.
And by the way, speaking of Mars on Earth, sorry to interrupt, but I just saw for the first time, I believe that was the title of the video on YouTube. I don't know how I hadn't caught it before. So I had seen your longer film about the traverse of the vehicle you had, but your Mars on Earth film on YouTube is just spectacular, really something.
The one with the astronaut smart glove?
This was the one taken on the Pixel 3. It was more of kind of a general introduction to Devon.
Oh, that one, yeah.
Yeah,
so Google
really
came
beautiful.
Up with us a couple years ago. That's right. That's called Mars on Earth, A Visit to Devon Island.
Yeah.
So that was filmed on a Pixel 3. It's an introduction to just life at our base camp. And it's recent enough that it's current, essentially. The other video I would recommend people to watch for Devon Island is Mars on Earth, the astronaut smart glove. Astronaut smart glove. We're very proud of that one because it's really promising technology for you know future EVAs that you're going to see there. And then as far as my paintings are concerned, you could go to pascallee.net and go from there to visit.
Good. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you for the shout out on that.
Yeah, now that we're sending millions of listeners to your site, I better scoop up the ones I want before they get there and start bidding the prices up. Tariq, before we wrap up, where can we go to learn more about what you're up to and what's happening at space.com? And I just kind of gave it away, didn't I?
Yeah, well, I would just point out that the future on Mars looks bright. I think Pascal seems to agree, but we clearly have lots of challenges. I am very much looking forward to more immediately the solar eclipse of April 30th that folks should look at, and they can find me and that at space.com this weekend, and at space.com, or I'm on Twitter at Tariq J. Malik.
And that is a partial everywhere, right, this time?
It's partial a partial eclipse. Solar eclipse, but you have to be in South America, so I will be watching it online.
Oh, very good. That's the safest place because I don't need my eclipse glasses. Well, I want to thank you for joining us, Pascal. Let's remind everybody
you.
You're a planetary scientist and director of the Mars Institute, polar adventurer, painter, and did I forget? Oh, yes, brain surgeon. And we'll be back next week with
my
our
brother.
List.
That's not me.
What's that?
That's my younger brother. It's not me, the brain surgeon.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess you guys split the buckaroo bonsai. Listing. We'll be back next week with our list of the very best and very worst space movies of all time. If you want to suggest your own best and worst films or make any other suggestions, so long as they are generally civil, please feel free to email us at twis@twit.tv. That's twis@twit.tv. New episodes and more bad jokes publish every Friday on your favorite podcatcher, so make sure to subscribe, and please tell your friends if you enjoy the show. And if you don't enjoy the show, tell your friends anyway. And you can head to our website anytime at twit.tv/TWIS. See you next time.
Listeners of this program get an ad-free version if they're members of Club Twit. $7 a month gives you ad-free versions of all of our shows, plus membership in the Club Twit Discord, a great clubhouse for Twit listeners. And finally, the Twit Plus feed, with shows like Stacey's Book Club, The Untitled Linux Show, The Giz Fizz, and more. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit. And thanks for your support.